Section 1. The Passion of Pliny the Elder. Pliny the Younger wrote a lot about his uncle and adoptive father, Pliny the Elder. We've met these Plinys before, in Chapter 8. We have abundant direct and indirect textual, eyewitness, and archaeological evidence of Pliny the Elder's life and influence, and know far more about him than Jesus. Likewise, Pliny the Younger, both making a good example of the kind of evidence we could have had for Jesus had he been as famous or as influential. And the younger Pliny's good friend Tacitus was fascinated by his uncle's heroic death. So he wrote Pliny a letter, asking him to tell him all he knew about the circumstances of the elder Pliny's death and how he bore it and how he acted in his final days. Tacitus wanted to include something on it in the history he was writing, but it's obvious he really just wanted to hear about this remarkable and heroic story. Who wouldn't? Human curiosity is universal, and something like this could not just be let aside as of no interest. The circumstances of his death, after all, were, quote, so memorable that it is likely to make his name live forever, end quote, as written by Pliny the Younger. Much like Jesus, according to some. Glad to answer Tacitus, the younger Pliny wrote him a letter containing an extensive eyewitness account of all he saw and knew about his father's death, in around 1,500 words. This letter is, by the way, a good example of what an honest, straightforward historical account looks like, in contrast to the farcical literary artifices of the Gospels, as shown in the previous chapter. That is not to say that nothing in Pliny's account can be questioned, but rather that Pliny is doing precisely what the authors of the Gospels were not, to the extent that we know we can trust most of what Pliny says, but none of what the Gospels do. In Bayesian terms, Pliny's letter contains attributes that place it within a completely different reference class from the Gospels, one in which the prior probability of honesty and reliability is far greater. It's packed with information about its subject, in fact, and yet it's just 1,500 words long. For comparison, Paul's letter to the Galatians, one of his shortest, contains around 3,000 words. Romans, nearly 10,000, although either or both may be a pastiche of what had previously been several short letters. For example, there is evidence that Romans was originally at least three separate letters, one of which was actually a church manual, that was split up and merged with an unrelated letter on a similar subject, and then a third letter was tacked on to the end, chapter 16, originally a standalone letter of introduction for Phoebe, as noted in Romans 16 verse 1, which itself has become corrupted. Many manuscripts show that Romans 16 verses 25 to 27 was originally part of another letter, and indeed it more logically belongs after Romans 14 verse 23, while Romans 16 verses 17 to 20 is even more clearly out of place and has probably likewise been displaced from that other letter, although we do not have clues as to its original location. Romans has been all more or less edited to make the resulting Frankenstein's monster look like a single continuous letter. See Junji Kinoshita's article, Romans, Two Writings Combined, in Novum Testamentum, Volume 7, October 1965. Many scholars suspect the letters to the Corinthians, Galatians, Philippians, and Thessalonians are likewise mishmashes of what were originally multiple letters, and not necessarily to the same destinations, and that some letters are redactions of others. But of original material, overall, we have around 20,000 words from Paul. But in Pliny's mere 1,500 words, we learn that his father died from respiratory failure after breathing the ash fall of Mount Vesuvius in his attempt to investigate the disaster and rescue survivors as commander of the Roman naval fleet stationed nearby. Pliny relates as much detail as he was witness to and those present informed him of. Pliny's response piqued Tacitus's curiosity and questions even more, and he wrote again, asking what the younger Pliny himself did in the days immediately following that tragedy. Pliny again obliged him with an account of that in a following letter. As Pliny says, quote, "The letter which you asked me to write on my uncle's death has made you eager to hear about the terrors and also the hazards I had to face," end quote, afterward. This is the kind of exchange of letters we should expect to have from the earliest Christians. Not necessarily in every respect, but surely something like it. Curiosity, the burning desire to know, to have first-hand accounts, to to have specific questions answered and desires for knowledge satisfied, would dominate every congregation under Paul and beyond, most especially in respect to the Son of God and Savior of the universe, whose deeds and speeches and death were, for them, the most important in all of history. The same burning desires exhibited by Tacitus and eagerly satisfied by Pliny would have been multiplied 100-fold in the 2 decades of Paul's mission, giving the number of Christians and distant churches there were by then spanning 3 continents. For not even one person to have ever exhibited this interest in writing, nor for any to have so satisfied it, is bizarre. Saying this all went on in person is simply insufficient to answer the point. If everything was being resolved in person, Paul would never have written a single letter, nor would his congregations have so often written him letters requesting he write to satisfy their questions, which for some reason always concerned only doctrine and rules of conduct, never the far more interesting subject of how the Son of God lived and died. On the other matters, Paul was compelled to write tens of thousands of words. If he had to write so much on those issues, how is it possible no one ever asked for or wrote even one word on the more obvious and burning issues of the facts of Jesus' life and death? This oddity is all the greater given that there were countless moral and doctrinal disputes arising in these congregations, the very reason Paul wrote such long and detailed letters, which must necessarily have rested on many questions that the actual facts of Jesus' words, life, and death would have addressed, answered, or pertained to. Such facts would thus necessarily become points of query, debate, and contention, which in turn would have involved eyewitnesses weighing in, either directly writing letters themselves, indirectly by dictating letters through hired scribes, which were abundantly available for just that purpose. There were surely even scribes within Christian congregations willing to volunteer, or by proxy, communicating with educated leaders like Paul, who would then relay what they learned. I've made this point already in chapter 8, but it bears repeating here because it proves by contrast how very bizarre the letters of Paul actually are. It is crucial to understand the methodological logic from here forward, not only when we think about what's just been said, but even more so when we go through the remaining sections of this chapter. Because although the following applies to every piece of evidence examined in this book and beyond, here biases are the most pernicious. If you approach the text with gut reactions of what you think Paul or any author probably meant, you are not thinking in a logically sound way. Those estimates of probability are in fact measures of the strength of your bias toward one conclusion over another, and not the probability of those biases being correct. Hence, those probabilities, those estimates, those gut feelings are precisely what you should discard. This is why we need Bayesian reasoning, to prevent us from simply enshrining our biases as the truth. On this point, my book Proving History is essential reading. You would have to justify those biases at the stage of determining the prior probability, as we examined in chapter 6. Otherwise, you cannot abide by them at all. The logically correct way to reason from evidence to a conclusion is to assume that a hypothesis is true for the sake of argument. In other words, wholly regardless of whether you already think the hypothesis is probable or not, you must assume it is not only probable, but in fact true. And then you ask how likely the particular piece of evidence you are looking at would be in that case. You must do this for both competing hypotheses, thus generating 2 estimates of probability, not 1. Thus, you must assume minimal historicity is true, then estimate how likely the passage you are looking at would be what Paul would write, for example. But you must also assume minimal mythicism is true, and then estimate how likely the passage you are looking at would be what Paul would write in that case. The difference in those probabilities is the weight of the evidence, toward whichever hypothesis entails the higher of those probabilities. If there is no difference, then the passage argues for neither hypothesis. It is equally likely on either one. The reason I make a point of this is that the most common and wholly erroneous way scholars look at arguments like the following is to simply assume, a priori, that a particular interpretation is unlikely. But that is simply a measure of the strength of your bias. It is not a measure of any logically valid effect of that evidence on your conclusion. The question you should ask here is not, is that likely what Paul would have meant by that, but rather, if Paul was in fact a mythicist, is that likely what he would write? And then, if Paul was in fact a historicist, is that likely what he would then write? For the comparative probability. You will find time and again the answer to the first question is yes, almost certainly. Which means that the passage cannot argue for historicity even if Paul was a historicist, and even if historicity happened to be true. Because if a passage is already effectively 100% what we expect on mythicism, its likelihood on historicity cannot be any significantly higher, since 100% is as high as any probability can be. And thus, the difference in those two probabilities will favor neither hypothesis, even at best. That is, even if the passage is also 100% what we expect on historicity. And if that passage, or chapter, or letter is not what we expect on historicity, but looks a little weird in that case, then that probability has to be less than 100%, even if only a little, and that means the evidence argues against historicity, even if only a little. So even if, for example, a passage is 90% expected on history, and thus very probable in that case, if that same passage is 100% expected on myth, then that evidence argues for myth, because the probability of historicity must then be multiplied by 9/10 on that evidence. A small reduction, but a reduction all the same. I'll say more about that in the next chapter. This is often hard for historians to grasp, because they typically have not studied logic and don't usually know the logical basis for any of their modes of reasoning, and thus have all too often simply enshrined ad hoc estimates of their bias strength as arguments for a conclusion, which is not logical. The consensus in history, in fact, is often based on that faulty logic, which is why history as a field has a deep and abiding methodological problem, and consensus is not an intrinsically reliable guide to what's true in history. See chapter 1 again of Proving History for how bad this has become in the study of Jesus, though the problem is not unique to that topic. I am not the first to point this out, by the way. It was extensively documented by David Hackett Fisher in Historians' Fallacies Toward a Logic of Historical Thought, published in 1970. So when we approach interpretations of the epistles of Paul, as with any evidence at all, we must look at each passage with the assumption that mythicism is true, something historians of Jesus have typically never done, and then estimate how likely it would be that the passage would look like that. And then look at that same passage with the assumption that historicity is true and do the same. The latter probability may even be high, but is it as high as the probability on mythicism? Is it higher? That's the only question that logically matters, because what we want is the difference in those two probabilities. Though biases can still affect these estimates, we are at least not simply using our biases as our premises, but actually attempting to reason out which theory the evidence fits better, and taking both theories seriously when we do. With that understood, we can proceed.